From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. We're monitoring tropical storm Isaias as it moves up the East Coast. We'll get the latest on that in a bit.
But first to Washington, where negotiations continue on another round of pandemic economic relief as the death toll from COVID-19 in the U.S. now tops 155,000. Joining us now is Robert Costa, national political reporter with The Washington Post. Robert, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
Well, what is the latest on the talks on Capitol Hill? Do you think there will be a deal this week to help the millions of people who, as of last Friday, stopped getting that extra $600 a week in unemployment benefits?
It's unlikely that a deal will be voted on in Congress this week, but it's likely that by the end of this week, Congress could come together. And the reason for that, based on my reporting, is that both Democrats and Republicans, just weeks before the election, just a few months before voters go to the polls, know that the country's in an economic and health crisis. And so there's a lot of motivation to get something done. But we're in this final stage where they're all posturing politically, trying to wrangle one other thing from the other side.
Which party has the most to lose if there is no deal?
Talking to Senate Republicans and their advisors in recent days, it's clear that the Senate GOP feels most vulnerable if they don't get a deal, because the House Democratic majority is likely to be uncontested. There's always an outside chance Republicans make gains, but every strategist, every pollster I talk to says the House is going to likely remain in Democratic hands. It's the Senate that's up for grabs, and senators like Martha McSally in Arizona, Cory Gardner in Colorado, Susan Collins in Maine, to use that old phrase, their voters are looking not just for whether they're with Trump or not, but whether they're bringing back the bacon when it comes to testing, money for schools and other issues, and especially that unemployment benefit supplement.
Robert, given the gravity of the situation, does it surprise you that apparently President Trump has not really been involved in the negotiations and that Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell, the leaders of each party in the Senate, aren't talking much with each other?
It's an understanding on Capitol Hill that the dynamics are best when President Trump stays out of the mix. And this is kind of a quiet, but not so quiet understanding. In recent months, every deal has been cut at the end of the day by Speaker Pelosi and Secretary Mnuchin. Mnuchin is not known at the Treasury Department as an ideologue. He wants to get a deal done. President Trump and Speaker Pelosi don't have much of a relationship. The wild card this time around is new chief of staff at the White House, Mark Meadows, a conservative who's been pushing for different concessions from the Democrats. This was likely moving toward a deal, again, cut by Pelosi and Mnuchin, but the entry of Meadows into the process has made it lag along.
President Trump gave an astonishing interview to Axios' Jonathan Swan in which he defended his handling of the pandemic. Let's listen.
We're lower than the world.
Lower than
We're
the
lower
world.
Lower than what is that? Europe.
In what? In what?
Take a look. Right here. Here's case death.
Oh, you're doing death as a proportion of cases. I'm talking about death as a proportion of population. That's where the U.S. is really bad.
Well,
much worse than South Korea, Germany, etc.
You can't do that. You have to go by where. Look, here is the United States. You have to go by the case.
It goes on, and there's a lot more in that interview. But on the issue of coronavirus, an NPR poll out today shows 2/3 of Americans think the U.S. handling of the pandemic is worse than other countries, and they want a national approach to reopening schools and businesses. Do you think there's one in sight from the president?
There's a lot of concern in the president's circle. I was talking to a Trump advisor the other day, and they said the president's not running against Biden. And I said, what do you mean by that? And they said he's running against the virus. That's the opponent here. And that's the main challenge for the White House. The problem for the White House is that they encouraged a lot of this country to reopen. And now schools are going to reopen in just a few weeks in many parts of the country. You could see spikes in places that are red and blue. And for many in the Republican Party, this was largely seen for weeks and months as a blue state problem, a city problem in Houston and New York and in Chicago and other places, Washington, D.C. Now it's seen as a red state problem, and that's complicating everything politically for this White House.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Robert Costa. There are primaries today going on in Arizona, Michigan, Missouri, Washington, and Kansas. In Michigan, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib is facing a primary. She just barely won the last time around. And in Kansas, former Secretary of State Kris Kobach is facing a crowded Senate primary. What are you watching for today?
You got to pay attention to Kansas. Roger Marshall, a congressman, versus Kris Kobach, Kansas's Secretary of State, for the seat now held by retiring Senator Pat Roberts. McConnell, the majority leader, wants to make sure Kobach doesn't get that seat. He's seen as a incendiary conservative, someone who's worked on hardline immigration policy for years. And McConnell, who's desperate to keep that Senate majority, thinks if Kobach's in there, he'll pull down the entire Senate GOP. So look, if Marshall wins, McConnell's the winner today. If Kobach wins on his own without much help from the national party, you can see the party nationally really moving in the direction of President Trump.
That is Robert Costa, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Robert, thank you.
Thank you.
Thousands of people have been evacuated as a massive wildfire consumes parts of Southern California. The Apple Fire has been burning for several days, and officials now believe it was caused by a malfunctioning diesel vehicle. For more, we have science reporter Jacob Margolis with member station KPCC. And Jacob, give us a sense of how far this fire has spread.
Yeah, the fire started on Friday afternoon and quickly grew to more than 26,000 acres over 4 days, which is pretty quick. It's been dry. It's been hot in the area for a while now, like over 100 degrees, which means that the moisture content of the plants is low and they are ready to burn. If you watch a time lapse of the fire, you can imagine these hills right up against the city, and they're slowly being consumed by a wall of orange. I mean, this, it's so big that the smoke is visible from space.
Oh, wow. Where are we now with firefighters being able to contain it?
Yeah, they're slowly getting a hold of it. Southern California is full of these communities that are kind of right up against these big mountains. And when those mountains catch on fire, the terrain can obviously be very steep. There aren't roads for fire trucks. And that also means that hand crews, firefighters on the ground who are going to dig a line around the fire, have trouble getting to where they need to be to stop it because you just can't hike through all these places. So where they can't hike or, maybe the fire is just moving uphill too fast, they can't get around it, they have been relying on airplanes and helicopters to drop fire retardant, which is typical. And it is going to stay hot and gusty in the area where this fire is burning, but winds aren't so crazy that they won't be able to get a hold of it. So I don't want to give a timeline for when, because anything could happen, but I would imagine slowly containment will increase over the next week.
Tell us a little bit more about how this fire was started. Fire bosses are saying that it was a diesel vehicle.
Yeah, most wildfires are started by people, so this isn't surprising. You know, someone stops on the side of the road, their car malfunctions, sparks kick out. There's not a ton of details about this, but basically those sparks then fly into some grass along the road, and then that grass catches on fire. It burns really fast and hot. The wind pushes the fire along. Big shrubs burn, and then big trees burn. You know, as another example, there was a fire last year that was started by a dump truck dumping burning garbage next to a mobile home park, and people ended up dying. All of that said, wildfires are very much a natural part of our landscape. We're just living like more and more in the parts that burn. So we rush to put them out, the fuel builds up, and eventually when these fires do start because of some spark or something, we get a major conflagration that runs through the area.
Let's talk a little bit about those impacted. Thousands of people have been forced to evacuate amid this pandemic. What steps are local officials taking to keep them safe, especially in light of COVID-19?
Yeah, we've seen on a couple fires this year that people are being put up in hotels to keep them isolated. On some fires, I haven't seen that on this fire, but on some other fires, they actually have people wait in their cars in the parking lot before giving them instructions at the evacuation center as to where to go. My colleague Josie Huang was down at an evacuation center on Sunday and only saw a few people there. And oftentimes what I've found on a lot of these fires is that people will go to an evacuation center if it is the middle of the night. But oftentimes the next day, especially if they have the means, they will go find a hotel on their own, or they'll just camp out in their cars. I met a lot of people in the Ralph's parking lot last year on a fire out near Santa Clarita, and they'll just wait until the flames pass, they're allowed back into their area, and they'll go home. The good thing is that usually structures don't burn because firefighters do such a good job saving them here.
You know, you mentioned it's been hot, it's been dry. Northern California, Oregon, Nevada, all of these states have seen an uptick in fire activity as a result of a drought. But Southern California isn't actually officially in drought this year. Were you expecting this big of a fire at this moment? We're talking the beginning of August.
I'm not surprised. If you've watched the progression of fires in Southern California, you can see they've grown from grass fires to shrub and brush fires to now we're looking at forests burning. And what that progression had to do with was different plants dry out at different rates. And so when the bigger plants dry out, then you've got these bigger masses of fuel to burn. And those fires are more difficult to put out. But usually we get to see, we don't see that terminal dryness until, I don't know, sometime in August, or late August or so. So we're a bit early. But the thing that's kind of saved us from an even bigger fire is we don't have those Santa Ana winds, which will come along in September and October. And that's when I will be back on with you and we will be talking about some absolutely devastating, fast-moving fires, which are very scary.
Oh, man. That's KPCC reporter Jacob Margolis. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Many battleground states in the run-up to the presidential election will be sending out mail-in ballots this month, and the U.S. Postal Service is caught in the crosshairs of a major political battle over the integrity of the mail system. Despite evidence, President Trump has said voting by mail will result in a corrupt election. And this battle comes as the USPS struggles with deeper funding problems. Joining us now to talk about this is Mark Diemenstein, president of the American Postal Workers Union. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so let's talk briefly about how these funding cuts have impacted the U.S. Postal Service as we head towards the election. Newly appointed Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, a major donor to President Trump's campaign, has issued guidelines that, among other things, takes away overtime for workers. And this is of note because this system is kind of a built-in overtime system for postal workers to complete their routes. Are delays happening right now, and how prepared is the U.S. Postal Service to structurally take on this process of mail-in voting?
Listen, there's no question that some of the new policies that the new Postmaster General put in, he's only been there 6 weeks, he comes from the business side, and he needs to learn that it's not called the United States Postal Business, it's called the United States Postal Service, and that's for a reason, and service should always come first. So it's very troubling for postal workers, and certainly the union opposes, and we've made our voices clear to this Postmaster General that we oppose any slowing down of the mail. Now, can the post office handle mail balloting? Absolutely. The post office has huge capacity. Five states have voted by mail by law for a number of years now. 31 million people voted by mail in 2018. We've been doing it for generations. It's part of our civic duty. We move the president's vote by mail and his absentee ballots and are proud to do that and get it to its destination. And anybody who's claiming that this is a system that's corrupt and fraudulent, that in itself is a fraud. It's just not the case, and it's not the history, and it's not the truth.
But I want to drill down with you. Do you believe these slowdowns will impact the mail-in election process?
First off, we want the Postmaster General and the post office to fix the problem. Secondly, if the mail is slowed down somewhat, it doesn't change the integrity of the system. What it means is the states who run the elections, the post office does not run elections. The states that run them may have to get ballots in the mail a day or two or three earlier. People may have to be more cognizant about voting sooner rather than later. And of course, a lot of the states, it's a postmark. So as long as it's postmarked, then the ballot will be counted. Our goal is to make sure the ballots are there on time. And every vote is accounted. So, yes, on the one hand, it's troubling that mail is going to slow down for everything we do, including balloting. On the other hand, the states are fully capable of taking into account the speed of the mail.
Well, the new Postmaster General says that these cuts have to happen as a cost-cutting measure. Democrats are requesting in this pandemic relief bill additional support for mail-in voting, which would offer some relief to the Postal Service. But what do you say to this postmaster's assertion that these cuts are needed?
What we say is this, that what's happening now and the squeeze on the Postal Service finances and their projected finances is really related to the COVID-induced economic crisis. The post office does not run on tax dollars. A lot of the listeners may not realize that. It runs strictly off the revenue of postage and postal services, and that has to be enough to be able to allow us to carry out our universal service mandate. That means we go to every address every day, no matter who we are, where we live, and it's an equal small d democratic right of the people. But the pandemic has caused a 30% drop in mail. It's been temporarily made up with the increase in packages as people are sheltered in place, but that's not going to last. So the post office themselves have projected a $50 billion loss over the next 10 years due to COVID. So what Congress needs to do, and they should have done it in March when there was a huge stimulus CARES package of $3 trillion, and they took care of the private corporate sector with $500 billion. It should have happened then, but there's a $25 billion ask, in this case of appropriated taxpayer relief as emergency funding to the public postal service. It's about time they take care of the public side. So what we say to the PMG is, let's help get this emergency funding, let's get through this COVID pandemic, and get back to doing what we do best. But the last thing you do is cut and slash, drive away business, drive away revenue, lower people's confidence in something that they use in many different ways, but is very dear to the heart of the American people.
My last question for you, you know, you represent postal workers. They're essential workers in the midst of this pandemic. They're out there every day. What are you hearing from them on really the state of their everyday jobs and how all of this is impacting them?
Well, obviously, the postal workers are deeply concerned about their own health and safety, but people have still gone to work. And I think it underscores the pride, the dedication to the mission, even in these difficult times. But it's very demoralizing for postal workers. We're raised in a system to say, never leave any mail behind, to act, never leave any mail behind, get it to the customer, go the extra mile. And now we have policies from this new PMG that says, you know, hey, if it's another 10 minutes to get everything in that truck, it's not going, that truck's leaving. If it's 6 o'clock in the morning and that mail needs another 10 minutes to get in there, sorry, it's going to wait till the next day. That's counter to our DNA.
That's Mark Demenstein, president of the American Postal Workers Union. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
The number of suicides in the U.S. has been rising for decades, according to the CDC. And this year, the city of Chicago is seeing a steep rise in suicide among Black people. Lakedra Chavez is a reporter for The Trace, and she's been covering this story and joins us now. Hi, Lakedra.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yes, so you write that in Cook County, Illinois, which includes Chicago and some of the suburbs, they're already seeing more Black residents die by suicide this year than in all of last year. Put this into context for us. What's going on?
Yeah, so we looked at 10 years of suicide data from the Cook County Medical Examiner, so from January 2010 to present. And as you mentioned, based on that data, the number of suicides that have happened for Black residents this year in the county has already passed all of 2019, which has essentially put 2020 on pace to be the worst year in the past decade. This is a trend that we are not seeing among white or Latinx residents currently in the county.
What do medical health experts you've spoken with say about why this is happening and what might help stop it?
Yeah, so it's really unclear why the suicides among Black residents have seen such an uptick this year. This was happening before the coronavirus pandemic really had an impact on Chicago. But we do know that Black communities in the city, especially low income, are disproportionately affected by things like unemployment, poverty, job loss, and access to mental health treatment. And these are things that have only gotten worse during the pandemic. These are also communities that are disproportionately affected by gun violence as well. So mental health professionals say that their clientele has essentially doubled since the pandemic began. And they're trying to help as much as they can, but they're already overloaded. But at least in Chicago, the existing resources are just not enough to meet the mental health needs that residents are experiencing right now.
You know, we've talked on the show about all of the things that you're talking about, the gun violence, unemployment. I'm thinking also about the mental and emotional toll of the pandemic, which you said this was happening well before that, but also the effect of this moment of racial reckoning. What is the sense that you've gotten from reporting on this? on how those factors, the pandemic and the reckoning, might be factoring in.
Yeah, so one mental health professional that I spoke to, who's a counselor here in Chicago, and about a third of his clientele are Black residents in the city. And he said that after George Floyd's death, it really opened up a lot of sort of unspoken trauma among his Black clientele, and that, you know, they were starting to process all of these really traumatic events in their life that they hadn't considered in that way previously. We do know that according to CDC data that things like anxiety and depression are up among Black Americans in general since the pandemic began. And, you know, they've only gotten worse since George Floyd's death.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the CDC's data really shows this. This isn't just happening in Chicago. I mean, a study published last year in the Journal of Pediatrics found self-reported suicide attempts among Black teenagers in particular has gone up more than 70% since the early 90s. Is this a broader trend? Have you looked into this particular part of the equation?
So it's unclear whether or not it's a broader trend. Like you mentioned, suicides in America have been increasing for the past few decades. And researchers are especially concerned about suicides among Black youth just because of the alarming increase that we have seen. In terms of the national data, there is a lag in what the CDC publishes for suicide data. So the most recent information we have is actually from 2018. So all of these stressors that people are feeling right now, especially Black Americans, we won't know the big picture, the whole picture, until, you know, likely 2 or 3 years from now.
That's Lakedra Chavez, a reporter for The Trace in Chicago. Lakedra, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Isaias is moving quickly up the East Coast today. It's a powerful tropical storm now with heavy rains, high winds, and tornadoes. Today, people are surveying the damage after what was a Category 1 hurricane made landfall last night in North Carolina. And for more on this, let's bring in Will Michaels. He's a reporter with member station WUNC in Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina. And Will, even though Isaias is once again a tropical storm, it was a hurricane last night, as I mentioned. What's the damage there?
Well, Tanya, we know today that at least the storm is being blamed for at least two deaths in the town of Windsor, North Carolina, which is near the coast and was essentially right in the path of Isaias overnight. What we're hearing from local authorities there was that a tornado, as you say, spawned from Isaias in the wee hours of the morning, and it looks, indeed, the images that we're seeing from Windsor are of a debris field that's probably 200 to 300 yards long and went through a mobile home park there. The debris is what may have resembled homes at one point is just flipped over cars and pieces of wood that are strewn about. So it's really heartbreaking from Windsor in particular, because just from my own reporting, they suffered significant damage in 2018 from Hurricane Florence, and then in 2016 as well from Hurricane Matthew. Elsewhere in the state, the effects are what you might expect from a hurricane. There's flooding. There's coastal storm surge of 2 to 4 feet. And power outages were about 350,000 at their peak.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Governor Roy Cooper, we're seeing, and has been encouraging residents to evacuate. But with all of the concerns about spreading COVID-19, what's the state been telling people about shelters?
Yeah, that was one of the major unknowns here, was how to house people in shelters during a natural disaster while also having a pandemic. And the governor said, you know, we are practicing social distancing at all of these shelters. There will be PPE and people will be screened for COVID-19 before they come into these shelters. He was very optimistic about the capacity. But of course, if you're social distancing, there might not be as much room for people as there usually would be. The good news is, however, the most recent information shows that only about 5 or 6 people are actually at these shelters right now. So clearly there is enough room for people if they need it.
Mm-hmm. North Carolina is an important agricultural state. What do we know about damage to crops and livestock?
Well, the state agriculture commissioner said this morning that that's really on his to-do list today. He is going out to survey the damage. And of course, you know, eastern North Carolina is mostly rural. The vast majority is. And there's a lot of farmland out there. We are among the top states in the number of hogs here in North Carolina. There are hog farms all across eastern North Carolina. Not to mention the fact that, you know, anytime there's flooding, the North Carolina's top crops, the ones that they're known for, sweet potatoes and tobacco and soybeans are definitely a threat. So it really does remain to be seen at this point, but that's something that state officials are surveying today.
Well, Will, thank you so much for this update. Will Michaels is a reporter at WUNC talking with us about the latest on Hurricane Isaias. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
President Trump says he will sue to stop Nevada from going to an all-mail-in voting system this November. The governor there signed legislation into law yesterday afternoon after the Democratic-controlled state legislature passed a bill over the weekend.
Secretary will close the roll. The vote on Assembly Bill 4 is 13 in favor, 8 against. The bill, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Order the Assembly.
The state will send a mail-in ballot to every registered voter as a result of the state of emergency because of the pandemic. That would make Nevada the eighth state to go mail-in, and it is a battleground state. Bert Johnson is legislative reporter for KNPR. He joins us from Reno, Nevada. Bert, the president is calling this an illegal late-night coup. Tell us what legislators there in Nevada did and why.
The state legislatures here in Nevada, or the state legislators here in Nevada, approved on Sunday night Assembly Bill 4, which creates a new category of elections called an affected election, and those take place whenever the governor or the legislature itself declares a state of emergency. And those affected elections are where you see the mail ballots being automatically sent out to all active registered voters in the state.
So they're going to go out to everybody who's a registered voter, an active registered voter in the state. Are people thinking it will work pretty smoothly given the tight timeline?
Yeah, well, that's the hope. Actually, right before they approved this bill, there was some reporting that indicated, you know, elections officials were getting nervous because it was getting right down to the wire. But the June primary election here in Nevada was conducted in a really similar way, and that did go pretty smoothly.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we said, President Trump threatened to sue the state, claiming that the governor made it impossible for Republicans to win there. What are Republicans in Nevada saying about this?
Well, they're not exactly saying that. A lot of the Republican lawmakers in the Assembly and the Senate raised some of the concerns we've heard on the national stage about the integrity of the election. You know, they say this will enable widespread fraud. There's also a provision in this bill that allows voters to delegate anyone they choose to turn in their vote by mail ballot for them, which is a little bit of a change that used to only be for family members. And Republicans are calling that quote unquote ballot harvesting. Although it's according to the folks who wrote the law, it's designed to allow people with disabilities, things like that, to be able to participate without exposing themselves to COVID-19.
One of the things that we hear about every time there is an election or a primary in Nevada is that there are all of these people who work in the casino industry, and it's very difficult for them to get the time that they need to vote. So if you have everybody voting by mail, that could make a pretty big difference in Nevada when it comes to turnout, right?
That's right. Actually, during the June primary, they had the highest turnout for a primary election we've ever seen. It was almost 30% here in Washoe County, where I live and work. It was 10% higher as compared to the 2016 primary.
So are people feeling that this is the end of the story? The bill has passed. It's been signed by the governor. Or are they sitting there waiting and bracing for a lawsuit from Washington?
You know, I haven't seen any really serious conversation about a lawsuit from the administration on the ground so far. Obviously, that's not impossible, but the president's tweets don't seem to correlate very well with what's happening here in the state.
Hmm. That is KNPR legislative reporter Bert Johnson joining us from Reno, Nevada. Bert, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it is summer, and traditionally that means it could be time for a family road trip. But of course, this is not a traditional summer by any stretch because of the pandemic. Still, people are traveling in some cases, and joining us now is one of them, NPR's Frank Langfitt, the London correspondent for NPR, who is just back from a summer road trip with his family in the United Kingdom. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, and just for context, the UK has the fourth highest COVID-19 death toll in the world. There have been more than 300,000 infections overall, but there were fewer than 1,000 new cases yesterday compared to about 48,000 new cases in the US. So would you say the outbreak is nowhere near as bad in the UK right now as it is in the US?
That's my impression, certainly. The United Kingdom government has made all kinds of mistakes in handling this. But right now, from all the numbers that I've seen, it feels very different here than all the impressions that I have mm-hmm. of the United States right now. It feels more open and safer to travel.
Okay, so tell us about your trip. You were driving on this trip. What was your original plan?
Well, the original plan, Jeremy, was to go to the States. Our daughter's going to college. And the college decided, like many colleges in the States, to go online, completely online. So there won't be students on campus. So we thought, well, there's no point in getting in an airplane to come across the Atlantic because of the risks. Then we were going to go to Ireland, drive to Ireland, get on a ferry. And the night we were going to go to Ireland, Ireland said, no, we don't want anybody from the UK. You'll have to come and do a 14-day quarantine. So that night we completely tore up that Ireland trip and we booked a trip up to Scotland. And so my wife behind the wheel, we headed up, really driving the length of the country.
And was there any traffic? Are people traveling right now?
They are, but not that bad. I mean, I think the roads were pretty fine. They were not the way they might normally be. What's interesting is people just aren't using much public transport. I don't think people are getting on the planes much. And I've been riding the trains as well. And often I'm the only person for reporting trips. I'm the only person in a carriage on the train. So most people were taking to the roads, but I think a lot of people are staying home. And the big difference is you don't have Americans here. Americans are really big travelers in the United Kingdom and Europe in the summer. And when we were traveling, we didn't see hardly any foreign tourists.
What about lodging? Did you feel like it was safe to stay in hotels?
Yeah, what we did is we tried to do Airbnbs. And the first one we did, we got like the last cottage in the Isle of Skye. I mean, really, I like booked it at midnight and there was nothing left. And for our listeners, the Isle of Skye is in the Northwest Highlands of Scotland. And we couldn't check in until 6 o'clock in the evening because they were doing a really deep clean from the day before. Other places where we stayed with hotels, they actually quarantined our room afterwards. So they didn't clean it for 2 or 3 days. And they, of course, they had such a high vacancy level. They could do that at a lot of hotels. So I wasn't that concerned about that. I was a little more concerned with restaurants. I prefer to eat like everybody in this pandemic. I prefer to eat outdoors. There were some times mm-hmm. where we couldn't get a table outdoor. We had to eat in. But every time you would walk into a hotel, every time you'd walk into a restaurant, there was always hand sanitizer. And so we would always put that on our hands on the way in and on the way out.
Were there any other limits on what you could do on this trip?
The museums are not open yet. So we went to the Beatles Museum. There's it's the Beatles story in Liverpool, and it was not crowded at all. And we were able to wear our masks, and that was great for the kids because they'd grown up with Beatles music. But for instance, in Edinburgh, there was nothing open. So like learning about the history of Scotland, you know, you just didn't have that opportunity. You had to look at YouTube videos and stuff like that to supplement mm-hmm. what you were seeing. But those museums are now opening up. Just, I think, on August 1st, more and more of them are opening up around the country. But people are anticipating a second wave and expecting that things could shut down in the early fall. It'll just depend on the numbers.
You know, Frank, in this entire experience, one of the things that I've heard and one of the things I've experienced myself is that while you may not be able to do a lot of the things that you could do before, you might see some new and different opportunities in the situation, especially on a trip with your family. Did you find that this gave you anything like that?
Absolutely. And I think it was actually in some ways a really, really good thing. Normally, I would drag the kids to museum after museum after museum. But this was a chance to see the great outdoors of Great Britain, which it's a beautiful country, subtle beauty, not like the Western U.S., but really pretty. And so we did all these hiking trips. And my son, Christopher, is 16. He loves to hike. And so this was, to him, I think, probably the most fun trip he's had.
Did you let him try any scotch in Scotland?
Well, Jeremy, I can tell you he has developed a taste for scotch. I don't know whether that makes me a good parent or not. But traveling in Scotland, it is a part of the culture.
It is indeed. NPR's Frank Langfitt joining us from the United Kingdom after a trip with his family. Frank, thank you.
Great to talk, Jeremy.
And, you know, before you have that scotch in Scotland, it's worth trying the Scottish salmon, the Scottish mussels, so many delicious things. One day we'll be able to go back to the UK and Scotland again.
The Sierra Club surprised many of its members and others recently when it apologized for its, quote, substantial role in perpetuating white supremacy and for the racist views of its founder, John Muir. The 128-year-old environmental group is one of the largest of many groups, national and local, around the country that are actually reconsidering such issues and the role that systemic racism may play in their work. Julie Grant of the Allegheny Front in Pennsylvania has the story.
When the clean energy group Penn Future adopted a new strategic plan last year, one goal was to increase diversity. But according to President and CEO Jackie Bonomo, the prescription in that plan, forming committees and reworking job descriptions, is already outdated.
Our thinking about what this work would look like has been upended. The world has changed.
In the protests that followed George Floyd's death, many environmental groups sent out statements of solidarity and called for an end to racism. Penn Future has a handful of people of color on their staff of more than 20, but Nomo says the organization needs to work on being anti-racist.
We need to do a heck of a lot more listening than we've done in the past, and more importantly, understanding the role that our organization plays in promulgating these systemic prejudices.
Rachel Filippini, executive director of the Pittsburgh-based GASP, the Group Against Smog and Pollution, says most environmental groups are well-intentioned and care about the communities that are impacted by pollution, but they need to change how they engage with the people who live there.
There has been this approach that is kind of paternalistic instead of collaborative, of just going into a community and pointing out their environmental issue, like, hey, you guys have the worst air in the nation, or whatever, and saying, you know, we're here to fix it, and this is our plan.
Filippini says with growing evidence that communities of color and those with lower incomes are more likely to face pollution exposure and associated health risks, environmental groups need a new approach.
If we are going to work on that problem effectively, then I think we've got to do a better job of including the voices of those most impacted.
Some of the nation's largest environmental groups are rethinking their work, too. Colin O'Mara is president of the 6-million-member National Wildlife Federation. When the pandemic hit, his conservation group stepped in to make sure water utilities in Flint, Michigan, kept the taps running for people struggling to pay their bills. O'Mara says those protecting water for aquatic life must also protect it for human life. And his members seem to understand that.
I think the assumption 3-4 years ago would have been that we would have received massive pushback, but something's changing in this country. I think it's seeing, not just hearing and reading about incidents, but it's actually physically seeing them, and that folks of all backgrounds are saying, now's the time to change the system.
Audubon has been working to make outdoor spaces more inclusive. The Pennsylvania chapter co-created the Discovery Center in 2018. It's a sanctuary for wildlife and migratory birds in a mostly black neighborhood near Philadelphia. Greg Goldman is Audubon Pennsylvania executive director and says they recruit employees from the community.
We really just wanted to make a real concerted effort to find the best possible people to staff our center and to reach out to the community, to bring community members into this work and to provide this education.
A 2014 survey of nearly 200 environment and conservation organizations around the country found that 15% of employees were people of color, compared with 38% of the general population.
So quite a disconnect.
Whitney Tome was, until recently, the executive director of Green 2.0. Since that survey, her group has been focused on tracking equity in the environmental movement.
Because it wasn't engaging people of color, wasn't reaching out to them when it came to the hiring, when it came to the recruitment of board members, etc.
Over the past few years, Green 2.0 has conducted an annual survey of the top 40 environmental organizations annually on their hiring practices. And Tome says things have improved. She's encouraged that diversity in the senior staff increased in 2019.
But we still got a long way to go.
Environmental justice pioneer Mustafa Ali worked 24 years at EPA and is now a vice president at the National Wildlife Federation. He says a growing number of people of color see the importance of protecting clean air and water in the environment and in their own communities. And when they're looking at which groups to support, they'll choose the ones that look like them.
If I am a person of color and I do not see myself represented in the leadership, into the sets of priorities and areas that you are focusing on, then I probably will make the assumption that this is not an organization for me.
Ali predicts that groups that shift to better represent the changing demographics of the country and that weave diversity and equity into the fabric of their work are the ones that will survive long term. For Here and Now, I'm Julie Grant.
And we want to take a moment to acknowledge that this pandemic has changed our lifestyles and even our listening habits, and you might actually be tuning in for the first time.
Imagine that. If you are, welcome. We are here every day bringing you the latest news with the resources of NPR, the BBC, and reporters in public radio newsrooms around the country. And it is supported in part by listener donations. So thank you.
And as we say every day, Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
I'm Tanya Mosley. The coronavirus pandemic has had an impact on the spread of other diseases. Shortages in PPE and other supply chain interruptions have made it harder to contain deadly diseases like tuberculosis, HIV, and malaria. Health experts now worry all of this could set the fight against those diseases back decades. That's next time on Here and Now.